Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, April 19th, 2012. Tonight, I'll be talking about a variety of topics. First of all, I want to remind you, a long time ago, I put an announcement out and I talked, I think I put a posting up and I talked about this on my show. It's called Ezekiel Bread. And this is something that was used, it comes from the Old Testament, and was used as a survival food. The other day I was talking with a woman, and she had called up asking some questions. And she said, she kind of described what they were doing, and she said, is there anything else I should be doing? And I said, well, are you doing any sprouting? And she said, no, she wasn't. So she had the water filters, she had the pre-filters, she had stored food, she had a garden. And I said, well, you know, if things get crazy, someone might come and grab the stuff out of your garden, or if there's some kind of a pollution event or something else, there's chances are that your garden may not be that useful, at least temporarily. So you need something to get you through times when you just can't leave your house or go outside, or maybe you have to go somewhere and kind of hang out for a while. And so what exactly would you do? And so I said, well, you know, sprouting is important. And historically, this goes back to the ancient Bible, but anyway, in other ancient texts. But Ezekiel bread is a bread that was made from sprouts, and it's very interesting. There's a number of different recipes. There's some other names for it too, sprouted bread or Ezekiel bread. But basically, wheat is the central grain that is used. You can also use chickpeas, lentils, millet, barley, other grains that you can sprout with, but basically you sprout not to the point where they're turning green or would start growing into the little plants. You're looking at maybe a half inch sprout. And then you stop the sprouting process and you grind this into kind of a ball of goo is the best way people can describe it. And then you bake this at a couple hundred degrees for, you know, some people say a few hours, but 3 to 4 hours, some recipes call for, some say 1.5 hours. But at any rate, basically what you're doing is creating a bread. So it's kind of a sprout bread. There's no leavening. There's no other ingredients. You can put anything you have handy. In it, you could put raisins or fruit, dried fruit, any kind of, you could put vegetables in it. So there's a wide variety of options when you're making this. But if you just eat what is called Ezekiel bread, spelt the same way as the Ezekiel, the book of the Bible, then this is a very essential food. And of course, sprouts, you don't have to cook or bake. But you do need clean water to make sprouts. And so anyway, that gets back to having a water filter so that you have clean water to drink, for washing, for sprouting, for cooking. And if you're like me, you use your water filter for everything. You don't use water out of the tap for really anything in the kitchen. Except washing dishes, of course. But back to Ezekiel bread, it's something everybody should try out. And everybody should be sprouting. I particularly don't sell anything for sprouting. But I encourage people. There's plenty of good sources out there. And there are sprouters, like little devices or container-type things that you can sprout with. After using many of these, I find that one of the problems with them is that they develop mold, and it's very hard to get rid of that in washing A lot of them you can't wash in a dishwasher, and who would have a dishwasher anyway in a time of an emergency? So I just use the old standard quart jar method. I take some quart jars are very easy to clean. The insides, you can clean them out and dry them out very well and use them over and over again. And then I get some of that plastic screen like you use nowadays. Instead of metal screen on your windows, they sell plastic screen. And so I buy a big sheet of that, cut it into squares that would cover a quart jar cover, and then use a rubber band or a string just to secure that to the top. And then once that's on there, once I put the seeds in the quart jar and then cover it with that wire or with that plastic mesh, then I never take that plastic mesh off again until the sprouting is done. And then I put in water from my water filter. You have to rinse sprouts at least every 12 hours minimum, because what happens is any seed is going to give off kind of an acidy kind of fluid as a byproduct, and you've got to wash that out of there. It's just like when you plant seeds in the garden, a lot of people don't understand that the rain not only nourishes the seed, it washes away residue that's given off by the seeds. And so it's a washing, cleansing process too. And that's why you can't plant corn or beans or other crops in the same area year after year, because that residue has to wash away from the soil. At any rate, so what I use is a quart jar. So just a little bit of advice there. Everybody should be sprouting, and it's good for your health. You should be doing these things every day. Every day you should be eating sprouts. And so try a little Ezekiel bread. Take some of your sprouts. Like I said, don't let them get too big, about a half inch on wheat, and other grains are might be a little bit different. But so you have a good rooting sprout. The process of sprouting, you want the root out there, but not the other part that would grow into the plant, that would go vertical upwards as the plant grows. You don't want that part. You want the root part of the sprouts. And then take that and grind it up. And you need quite a bit to make bread, so you would need, maybe 3-4 cups of seeds to really do a good job of making Ezekiel bread. And once again, the various, you can put raisins, nuts, all kinds of other additions, dried fruit, as I said. You can also, wheat, let me once again go over the type of sprouts that you would use for Ezekiel bread. Winter wheat or spring wheat, chickpeas, lentils, millet, barley, you could go down your whole list of, your favorite sprouts. Some people put radish sprouts in it, but the traditional Ezekiel bread, you can also look this up online and get a lot more information. Just wanted to remind people of that as we head into possibly some troubled times here. A way that's something you could do in your house. Sprouting is something that's nutritious. You get the vitamins and the nutrients that you need for sustenance, and you can go quite a while just eating sprouts. You don't need sunlight necessarily. You can eat them. You can do that in the basement or a closed in area, and it still is healthy. So everybody get out there and sprout and try some Ezekiel bread. The corn sale is still going on, and I just really want to kind of hammer on this right now, because we're approaching the planting season. This will be probably the last time I mention this, although a lot of the northern states don't plant until Memorial Day, so that gives us all of May yet to go. And the response has been very, very good, but it's not what I would like to see. I'd like to see more people promoting the non-GMO dense corn seed that I'm offering on the webpage. This is the second generation. And I find what's interesting is the people that bought it the first time back in 2008 and 2009 when I started this whole project, they don't need to buy anymore because they are already growing their corn and they're saving it. That's one of the amazing things about this is it's not something you have to buy and then you have to later on buy more of it. You buy it once and then you have your corn seed basically for life. You can give it away to other people and get them going on corn. But this is the kind of corn that was found on the family farm back in the 1930s. And I'll just give a quick history. A lot of people already know what happened. In 2008, in the spring of 2008, we had tremendous flooding, and it's something I covered a tremendous amount on the radio show. I investigated about the water that was, it was just a tremendous disaster because what happened, for example, the government of Iowa, where tremendous flooding was going on, what did they do? They turned to Coca-Cola and they buy immense amounts of bottled water and they bring it in. Well, first of all, how do you get this out to the people? And when they did get it out to the people, what do? You drink a liter bottle of water, and then the people are out in the middle of nowhere with flooded conditions. They throw the plastic bottle away. Now you have a tremendous pollution event with plastic bottles floating around all over the place. So it really ridiculous. I contacted them about using water filters. Oh, gee, that's too radical for us. No, we'll just stick with buying. You know, these people, emergency people, in my way of thinking, are just, you know, I just get frustrated, tremendously frustrated, because the way they just have no concept, and water is the absolute first thing that you should be dealing with when you have an emergency situation. You should be dealing with water. Excuse me, I'm adjusting my sound here on the on my end. I was getting a little blocking on the top of my recorder here. So, but it's water is so important. But anyway, back to the 2008 spring floods. What happened? I found out that there were three universities: Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin that were involved in a agricultural effort to bring back what is known as dent corn seed. It's a seed that, like I say, was the common field corn that you would have found on the family farm into the 1950s. If you were that old, you'd hang out at your friend's house in the country, and the kind of corn that they had then, and the farmers saved their own corn seed and had it for the next year, and they knew how to do this. And by the way, that was a tradition that went on for throughout the history of this country. People would meet at church or at community centers, and they always brought seeds. The women and the men were trading seeds, and do you have some of this kind of seed? Oh, yeah, and they would trade back and forth, and they would keep those seed lines viable. And so anyway, of course, people kept their own corn seed. Well, then in comes Monsanto. In comes Cargill, the big seed corporations. And I remember when some of the kids started going off to the university and getting educated on how to grow corn. Well, that's when the big production corn came in. The planting, the using ammonia fertilizers that came from petroleum. So this was the new wave of farming, the high production. Those were the guys making the big money that had the big tractors and stuff. And that was all good. But what happened after that was not really planned. The Frankenstein corn, the Frankenstein soybean, And then also the monopolization of food by the Cargills and the Monsantos and other companies that grow food. I covered, for example, the story in Molokai, Hawaii. I talked about this, was it a year or 2 years ago, I forget, where they Monsanto came in and took over the island water system that was developed for the people, for the pineapple industry, basically shut that down, and now the corn is the only industry there. And the people are basically slaves to Monsanto, and that little island is then their seed-generating factory, so to speak, for corn seed, the Monsanto monster corn or Frankenstein corn. Anyway, okay, so 2008, that spring, of the University of Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, the university agricultural departments had a project that they had been working on for many years to grow more corn seed of the old dense corn type, the old traditional corn type. And this was, let me read all the properties of this corn just so that we can, that you understand. These are open pollinated organic, true organic, non-hybrid, non-GMO, natural selection bred, no fungicides, no pesticides, no herbicides, no chemicals or spray, no preservatives. You can eat this corn. It's fit for human consumption and, of course, animal consumption. It's yellow dent corn seed. And this was, like I say, the type of corn on the family farm found back up to the 1950s. So at any rate, in the spring of 2008, all the flooding occurred, and all of the efforts, the number of years of developing this corn seed to the point where they could start distributing it nationally, all that was destroyed. Some of it, I understand, ended up in Brazil. And so Brazil now has a corn effort, and I understand some of it made its way to China. And so China has organic, non-hybrid corn. Places like Hungary and Yugoslavia have bulldozed under any Monsanto. They have outlawed Monsanto products. Monsanto recently has been invading Mexico, trying to force Mexico, the original source of corn, to monopolized by those companies. But what they're trying to do is destroy any semblance of this historically important grain. So at any rate, okay, back to 2008, when I was investigating the flooding going on, and there, of course, I was convinced that there was weather manipulation going on because of the way the waves, and I called it weather bombing, where these areas were just destroyed. And then we find out that some government people high up in the U.S. government come in and start buying up the land at rock bottom prices. So all of this going on, but at any rate, also at the same time in the background, not really big in the news, this corn crop of dent corn, which was getting to the point where it was almost ready to be harvested and then distributed nationally. And by the way, this was being developed for the chicken, for the organic chicken industry, because the organic chicken industry was demanding original corn without the monster additions from the hybrid companies, from the Monsantos and the Cargills. They were not going to allow that and then feed it to chickens and allow it to be called organic. And this was within the organic chicken raising industry. This was not a government regulation. This was a organic chicken raiser industry like rules, so to speak, that they were instilling. So anyway, all of this was coming to fruition when the floods hit and destroyed all of that work. In my investigation, I found one pallet of this corn seed that was left in the where I found it. They were going to grind it into chicken feed and just get rid of it because they didn't know what to do with it. I bought it, and I said, this cannot be ground into chicken feed. I then thought, well, what am I going to do with this? So I started looking around. I thought, well, I'll just distribute it through my radio show. And I did, and it went worldwide. It was tremendously successful. And now I'm involved in the second generation of this corn seed. This is the result of the first generation back then. And I have a picture, by the way, if you have not seen the picture on my webpage, there's an email that somebody who bought the corn back in 2008, somebody who raises corn, and the monster ears of corn that resulted, these ears of corn are like 2 feet long. They're just huge. So anyway, if you haven't seen those, go to my webpage. But okay, I won't go on about this anymore, but please, I'm asking you to take this initiative. If you do not grow corn, or you don't have a garden, order some and find somebody that does grow corn and give it to them. Out in the country, a cousin, an aunt, a grandma, somebody that you know, go to, and somebody had this idea. It was a great idea. Take it to your church or some organization you're in and say, here, this is some really amazing historical corn, and try and find somebody that would grow it. The other thing that I want to mention is that I have this in quantities of 200, of course, seeds, but you can buy 2,000 or 5,000 seeds. 5,000 seeds is enough for about a sixth of an acre, and some people are ordering two or three lots of 5,000 seeds just to have that quantity out there. But you can't find these quantities any place, because if you go to one of the heirloom seed places, you'll buy little envelopes with maybe 25 seeds in it. But nowhere on the planet are you going to get 5,000 seeds like I have available here. So at any rate, find somebody, buy it, and then either save it yourself, but it's best to plant and then expand it. Now, I want to go through some numbers here. And when you understand these numbers, you're going to understand why Monsanto is so religious about trying to destroy seed. Any of the natural seeds that have been around, of course, since time immemorial. Corn, of course, is a natural selection grain that came to us from South America. From the Aztecs were the ones who finally had the corn when it moved up into what we now call the United States. But let's take a look at a couple experiments. Let's take one seed of corn. Let that grow for a year, and you have about, let's say, 100 actually, probably more than 100 seeds on a corn ear of corn. But let's say you get 100 seeds out of that for the next year. We're looking at the expansion here of corn, the multiplication factor. Okay, after your first season, that one seed produces 100 seeds. Okay, so we're going up by a factor of 100 every year. After 2 years, that's 100 times 100, that's 10,000 seeds. That's after 2 years. Okay, after 3 years, the third year, that one seed turns into 1,000,000 seeds. You see what's going on here. And after the next year, we're talking 100,000,000 seeds. That's a lot of corn from one seed. Okay, now take 5,000 seeds. Now we're getting up into the billion seed range. Now you can see why Monsanto is so religious and so adamant about crushing any corn seed that's out there of this type, because they want to sell it to the farmer. I should make this clear that the Monsanto Cargill type of hybrid corn only grows for one season. Then the farmer has to go back and buy seed again. Every year, the farmer has to go back. With this kind of seed, the farmer has his own seed, and he doesn't buy it from any of the mega seed corporations. Remember also, if you go to buy seed at the seed store or the garden store or the grocery store, a lot of times in the spring there's a rack of seeds. Be careful, because you'll see a great big sign and it says organic. And you think, wow, organic seed. Well, 99.9% of it is hybrid, and that seed is a hybrid seed. It's something that will not grow the next season. You cannot save those seeds, and so you're dealing with some sort of laboratory seed production. So anyway, I want to encourage you to understand that. Organic simply means the kind of soil that it was raised in. Non-hybrid means that, of course, there's the type of selection which is natural, and of course it has occurred over the millennium with indigenous people who saved their own seeds, saved the biggest, best seeds to plant the next year, and of course through natural selection, that is a process by which corn that we have today was naturally selected. Corn, as it originally started tens of thousands of years ago by indigenous people, was a small grain, something about the size of a wheat stalk, and just a little kind of grouping of seeds, and it was naturally selected up to the point. Now, of course, there's dozens of varieties of corn, heirloom corn, but the availability of seeds is very limited. So at any rate, just understand, please, the difference between organic and hybrid. And not many people are going to put on their big seed stand, they want to stress organic. Or if you go to the seed store and you say, I want non-hybrid seeds, they're going to look at you like you came from outer space, because they can't sell you any. They don't have any. They get their seed. I would find it rare. They might have some. But like I say, you're going to get some little teeny package with 20 seeds in it, not 5,000. And it's going to cost you, you know, $3, $4, maybe $5 for a little package with a handful of seeds in it. Nothing that you can really go out and propagate yourself. And I would question, too, if they're not selling hybrid under some false pretenses. I would see that happening, because if you remember last week, I read the email from the woman that was talking about health food stores selling what they call raw almonds or raw nuts that had been steamed. They really weren't raw, and they wouldn't germinate or sprout. And so the health food store said, well, yeah, we're still allowed to say that they're raw when they really aren't. They're cooked, basically. So be very cautious. Now, so I want to repeat that what I am distributing here is organic, non-hybrid, non-GMO. These things have not been in the laboratory. Open-pollinated means that these are pollinated in the open air. Now, here's another thing I just want to mention. When you do buy these corn seeds, I send a complete set of instructions with them, including the history, introduction, explanation of all of this, where this all came from, and then I tell you how to plant and how to where to get more information about the pollination and the statistics of growing corn. Then I also tell you how to care for the plants and how to harvest the seeds, and how to keep those seeds for the next year. And so this instruction sheet, it's 3 pages typed, instruction sheet, comes with every seed order. Okay, so I want to just kind of hammer on this topic and encourage you that if you know somebody, or if you have a group you can take these to and say, who can grow these, and order them and distribute them, or order, say, 2,000 seeds and break it into smaller groups and distribute it to friends or cousins, or send it to someone. Order them and you get them, and then send them to someone else. Or you can also order on the page and order with your address, but then put down an address where they can be sent to. So at any rate, there's a number of possibilities there. So I'm just encouraging people to buy the corn seed and distribute it. This is a project that I feel very strongly about, because what we're doing here is preserving the third most important grain in the world that's under attack by the large seed corporations. And now I just described to you how important one seed is. One seed in 4 years, you get 100 million seeds in 4 years from one seed. That's why it's, you can see it's so important for Monsanto to crush any ability of the people out there to have this, because one seed can just multiply. So 5,000 seeds, or many people getting 5,000 seeds, or 2,000, or 200. By the way, 200 is the minimum, because you need that when it cross-pollinates. That's the minimum amount of seed that would cross-pollinate and give you a healthy stock. Any fewer than that, the seed stock gets weaker and weaker. It has to cross-pollinate with a wide variety of different plants to keep that seed stock viable. At any rate, I want to give one other quick example here. A guy named Henry Ford, back in the early 1900s, I believe this experiment was performed, he took a cubic inch, 1 cubic inch, that's a square, 1 inch by 1 inch by 1 inch, full of wheat. And that's not much wheat. That's, you know, maybe 100 or a couple hundred kernels of wheat. And started an experiment. And he did this at the bequest of another person, as I recall. And I'm sure there's information on the internet, more details. But here's basically what happened. They planted that, and they wanted to see how this multiplied. Okay, so after the first year, they got, you know, a number of wheat plants, and they were very selective and careful to save all the seeds from that first planting so that they could plant that the next year. Of course, the next year, they planted that and raised another crop of wheat. That year, they kept all of the seeds to plant the next year. After 7 years, they had enough seed. There wasn't enough land in the United States to plant all the seed that they had in 7 short years, starting with 1 cubic inch of wheat seed. So you can see how this just grows and grows, and how important it is. Corn is the third most important grain in the world. Rice, wheat, and corn comes after it. Now, I want you to do a little experiment if you're not quite sure. If you're like, and here's something that's going to happen. You're going to go out and talk to somebody who raises corn. And I know people. I live in the middle of corn country, Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin and the Dakotas and Nebraska. This is corn country in the world. There's more corn raised here than ever you could imagine. And you go out and you tell people about this, and they really think that old-fashioned corn really isn't very good. They don't like it. It's not modern. And they don't quite understand the concept that, for example, if you have a Monsanto Roundup Ready corn, the Roundup is actually in the genetics of the seed. And other chemicals are in the seed to resist insects, to resist weed growth around it. And I saw a field in Nebraska last summer. I was driving through Nebraska, and there was a series of fields that were vacant, because at first they had some flooding, because remember the river, Missouri River up there, that flooding issue, that was last spring. And then they didn't get to plant. So you would think, well, weeds would grow up or something would grow up in those fields, and nothing, not a blade of grass would grow in those fields. So I started going around and investigating. And I was told, oh, well, those are Monsanto corn fields. Nothing will grow there. After they spray that with herbicides, etc., The only thing that could possibly grow there is the type of corn that is resistant to those herbicides. So at any rate, since they didn't plant the corn, it was too late after the flooding, then literally nothing would grow there. They had poisoned the land so that nothing would grow there. I've talked to some organic farmers, and they understand that the majority of land in the United States has been destroyed. If you look on Google, I've mentioned this many times in my program, if you look on Google and you look for depleted land, just look it up in a world map, the most depleted, or some of the most depleted land in the world starts in Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, northern Oklahoma, South Dakota. But you look at this and you see vast fields of corn growing. I mean, 100 miles, 200 miles of corn in all directions. How can this be on the most depleted land in the world? Well, it's because they are putting fertilizer from ammonia fertilizers, and the plants look wonderful, but there's nothing there. Okay, now I want you to do something. If you're really in doubt about this and you have some farmers out there that, well, they just don't like that old-fashioned stuff. They like the new modern stuff. It's got, you know, anyway, do this. Go out into the countryside and go to a feed store and go in there and say you'd like some oats, you would like some corn, and you'd like some wheat grain. And they'll sell it to you in bags, 40-pound bags or whatever. And then tell them you want it for human consumption. They're going to look at you like you just fell off the banana boat because they don't have any. None of the food that they have in there, it's for animal feed, by the way, it's stamped right on the bag, not fit for human consumption, or not for human consumption. This is on the grains that come right out of the fields, and what they do is they spray it so nothing will eat it, and then this is fed to animals, and then, of course, you eat that. Gee, I wonder why we have a rising cancer rate in the world here today. But, right on the bag. This is fresh out of the field, not fit for human consumption, or not for human consumption. You cannot eat. So the hundreds of miles of corn out there sure looks good. I drove through that area last fall before harvest, and it was, like I say, hundreds of miles as far as the eye could see. Corn. Not any of it can you eat. Pretty amazing. So anyway, as I say, I feel very strongly about this non-GMO organic corn seed project that I'm involved in. So do your part if you can. The 200 seed package is just $17. 2,000 seeds is $60, and the 5,000 seeds is $110. And these all include shipping. Go to the website jmccsci.com. And all the details are there. The picture of the person holding these giant ears of corn are there. Okay, I have to change to some other topics, but this is probably the last week when I'll really talk about this. The planting season for the northern states, some people are already planting. I know down south, Louisiana, Oklahoma, those areas, they are planting right now. So you can still get this in the southern states. We're not sending any of this foreign. The other time I did, and this time no foreign orders, unfortunately. But if you got it and sent it to some foreign location where you knew it could go, well, that's you can do that. But we're not going to ship any to any foreign locations this time. Of course, all the water filters and the books, that goes all over the world. But the corn seed is just for the 50 states. Okay, so the other thing is please get this, and like I say, distribute it, find a place to plant it, and the only other thing you have to remember is if there is other corn in the area, the best way to deal with this is plant it at a different time so the pollination is occurring at a different time from the other neighboring corn. You don't want your corn cross-pollinating with hybrids, and you know they probably don't want their corn cross-pollinating with this. So at any rate, that's one way to deal with that. Or plant it away. If you have a field that's far away, remember that Monsanto has tried to sue farmers for growing corn other than their corn, and they say it's ruining their corn. Well, I mean, these people, what planet are they coming from? But that's how militant they are about destroying anybody else's ability to grow this corn and other crops. Okay, enough of that. I will move on. There's some other major topics to talk about tonight. Okay, I just wanted to clarify a topic that came up last week. I was talking about, I think it was last week or possibly 2 weeks ago, I was talking about the number 4 cooling pool at Fukushima. And a woman called in and she said, well, I thought that the number 4 reactor blew up. And so how could it blow up again? Well, it's a very complex situation with the cooling tower. And remember that the waste radioactivity has to be cooled. And so it's very important for these reactors to continue cooling, because the radioactive waste would just sit there and heat up and heat up until it melted the containers and spill out all over the place. So they have to keep the reactors going, and it's kind of a, you know, the old perpetual motion machine where it keeps running all by itself. Well, nuclear reactors are not perpetual motion machines, and the radioactive waste has to be cooled, so they have to keep this process going. And I can't even imagine the scientists on these projects and engineers who never thought that, gee, what if there's an accident, one of these babies shuts down, and you cannot continue to cool that nuclear reactor waste, which is going to be there for thousands, if not millions of years. I mean, what are these people thinking? Well, they weren't. They were just being led by a good paycheck in government programs, and inability to really look critically at the situation and say, hey, this isn't going to work. It's going to look good in the short term, but in the long term, it's a walk-in disaster waiting to happen. So anyway, I wanted to clarify that the situation at Fukushima is relatively complicated. We're talking about the cooling pools and the pool that would contain the heavy water if the reactor breaks down. The tower that held up reactor number 4 is critically damaged, and they don't know how to start lifting out the radioactive rods, the actual nuclear fuel. So it's just an absolute disaster over there. It's what the nuclear industry was bound to happen, and it is now underway. So we're looking at possibly a worldwide disaster that could literally kill all of us. And the United States would be one of the first places to get hit, but eventually that radioactivity would work into the oceans, it would spill out, the ocean currents would take it every place, eventually killing just about everything on Earth. And they don't know what to do with it, so the politicians are sitting there and pretending like nothing's going on. We have a president here that is lucky if he can pick his own nose. And some people think that, well, gee, if we elect a Republican, everything will be better. No, there's a political disaster. The people of this world have to take it back. And one of the big starting points is to take back science. Science and scientists are owned and controlled by the government. And that has been the key to many of these disasters, the nuclear industry being one of the prime examples. But at any rate, if you need more information about the details of what's going on at Fukushima right now, there is some good information online. It's a fairly complicated situation, but the situation, as I said, deals with the cooling pool, and more detail than I really want to give on the show. Just suffice it to say, there is a disaster in the making there, a second wave of disasters, I should say, and it's upon us. So, nuclear disaster. And the main reason I was talking about that is because last week, I believe it was last week, I talked about the five different sources of radiation that we're being submitted to right now. Okay, another topic that's been in the news, trumpeting sounds from around the world. And this is a topic that my name has been used. I've seen some of the reports. Some of them, I think, have been fairly clear and concise. But then there's some misinformation, and there's some people running around creating videos just to try and gain attention. But there does definitely seem to be some phenomenon. It's some drumming, trumpeting type of noises. So let me go into some explanations of what I think is happening. I believe some of these are underground. There's some booming noises underground. And these are localized. They're like the one up north of Detroit, just across the border in Canada, is a good example of underground activity. So not all of these are atmospheric. There are some other ones that are very definitely atmospheric. And so anyway, here's the situation. As the solar storm activity occurs, as Earth is caught in some of these wildly changing solar wind streams, what happens is the electromagnetic conditions around Earth cause electrical discharges in our local region in the solar system. The electrical currents come down attached to the upper ionosphere, and these can drain all the way down into the troposphere where the weather occurs. But a lot of this drumming noise might be up, 5-10 miles, and so it's heard over a broad area. The ancients talk about this. Now, I can't confirm myself because I have not personally been at these sites to personally confirm it, but it sounds like that is what people are hearing. Now, why would the government then probably propagate false information, goofy videos that come up on YouTube? Well, that's so that they have something to point to. And some of the analysis that I've seen, some of the videos trying to explain this, the ones used my name, I thought they were actually quite well done. A lot of times I oppose people using my name, but because here's what happens. Maybe they have a good report on one thing, but then they have some other things that I don't agree with. That's why I personally keep all of my analysis to myself, to my webpage. But I thought some of these were fairly well-balanced reports that, yes, around the world there is some trumpeting type of atmospheric noise going on. Then you have the standard litany of government-paid scientists who are trying to discount it or downplay it or say that, oh, that's not a big deal, it's just the auroras or whatever. Auroras make noise. I have personally heard auroras making noise. It's kind of a hissing noise. And one time I was in the woods up north of the not that far from the Arctic Circle, and I heard the electron stream, the secondary electrons, coming down and hitting the trees. It sounded like rain. It sounded like rain, and you could see the leaves responding to it. Hitting the leaves and it was like a electron shower, basically, secondary electrons that were coming down probably from a primary proton streamer that was coming in far, far above me up in the ionosphere. And in the daytime, a pure blue sky, and it was like raining, and I could hear it. And at night, the same auroras were going on. They cycle about every 6 hours. So at night there was tremendous auroras, and I could hear the auroras. So at any rate, but the trumpeting sound is more like the ancients talk about this, the various frequencies that they heard, some of them screeching, and of course that's back when the big, big comets were coming through the solar system, nothing like we're seeing now. but we're seeing it's interesting that people are actually recording these trumpeting noises, and what convinces me that they're real is large groups of people are reporting this, and they're reporting it to local governments, and local governments are responding. They're calling the military, asking what's going on. And the military, of course, is not saying anything. Well, they're supposed to be protecting our borders, and what do you mean they don't know what's going on, or they can't measure it, or they can't detect this, or like the drumming noise up in Detroit area? What do you mean the military doesn't know what's going on? If they don't, they're idiots. If they do, they're lying, or keeping it secret. So take your pick. Are they idiots, or are they lying? Well, I guess you take your pick. But either way, it's not good. So at any rate, I just wanted to make a comment. It does appear that there is trumpeting going on around the Earth, that it is the result of electromagnetic conditions in our region of the solar system. There is hoax-type activity going on. That's very clear. And then there's government people that they throw out there. And I always love these government people. They always wear a hat. You can always tell them when they're trying to debunk something or whatever. What is it about them? They always got a hat on, like a baseball cap or something. Anyway, whatever. On to the next topic. Oh, by the way, just on this atmospheric trumpeting, I coined a term here in just talking about this. I'm calling it ATN. N is in no. ATN, atmospheric trumpeting notes, N-O-T-E-S, or noise. ATN, so I'm calling it. So there's a mnemonic, and that's coming from me here on this date, April 12th. So that's a term that I will use to describe atmospheric trumpeting, ATN. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about this past week's severe weather. Himikanes, a number of them passing across the United States. Very severe storm activity from Texas to Canada. And I happened to be in the middle of one of these as came through the upper Midwestern states. In fact, the eye passed over me. I could see the wall clouds in the eye. It was very clear sky above. And then as the Himikane passed, I was able to see the band clouds out in the far reaches. I mean, these are structurally the same as a hurricane. And so a lot of severe weather here, obviously the result of solar activity. It looks like government agents, those outreach people, are trying to minimize the idea that these things, they're just pretty solar flares. Let's look at the pretty solar flares, everybody. That's what the web pages are saying. And, don't worry, the most that could happen is it could cause a power outage. No big deal. So ridiculous that trying to minimize what these can do. And, of course, I've said before that I believe that this spring the government is ready, based on some solar event that's going to happen, to pull the plug on the American power grid, and it'd be a way that they could shut down literally everything, shut down any movement, tell people they can't go anyplace for your safety, of course, and it would be a way for them to put in a certain element or a big element of control. Like I said, I don't think other countries are going to buy into this, especially Canada. And so I would see the way to detect that this is a false flag event is just look at other countries. Why would it just affect the United States? So that's something that, but the severe weather this last week definitely related to solar activity, solar flaring that's going on. And it looks like that's going to continue. As I talked about before, we've had major comets coming in into the region, right into the near region of the sun, causing major solar flare, kicking up that solar activity. And about a week ago, I reported before the show, the NASA feed for the SOHO satellites went out. I never could get back the pieces of that to understand what may have happened at that time. So that's the answer. Some people were asking about that, whatever happened to that. I want to talk a little bit about population curves here, and people might be wondering why I'm hammering on this topic. And it's because the United States is right now in critical condition, but here is what's going on, and it's very much related. The demographics reporting of the federal government on the Mexican population in the United States, and don't get me wrong, I have a lot of friends that are Mexicans. In the United States, I used to live in Mexico. I'm simply reporting the facts the way they are, the numbers. The government demographics of the Mexican population is extremely underestimated. And so anyway, let me explain the Mexican growth rate, population growth rate, starting in around 1940. Up to that point, it was relatively constant at around 400,000. And so after that, it started growing at a linear rate. But that's with a death mortality rate of children under 5 of about 50%. And so given that linear rate, if it weren't for the mortality rate, that would have been exponential. And Mexico today would have a population of around 400 million. Okay, well now what's happened is like I reported, the minimum number of Mexican adults in the United States today is around 40 million. Some people might put it at 50 million. And the birth rate is very high. So a lot of families with four or five children. Okay, all of a sudden we have a population of about 40 to 50 million minimum of kids under age 5 in the United States. These people are not counted. They don't turn up on the census. And the demographics, none of this is visible. So I just want to mention that. For example, India, when it started its population growth, India now approaching the most populous country in the world, heading for 1.6 billion people by the year 2020, started that same way. Once you hit the knee, what we call the knee in the exponential curve of population growth, then it takes off. You have 3 to 4 generations living at the same time, and it's amazing. This country could potentially have 700 million people in it within 10 years. India had a population of 400 million in 1961. It went to 1.1 billion in 2003. These are irreversible trends. Don't forget to go to the webpage jmccsci.com and order the corn seed. Propagate this for posterity. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.